WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Wendy Gillette. Israel says it's back, reinforcing the ceasefire following its strikes in Gaza, after it says troops came under fire from Hamas militants and two soldiers were killed. At least 19 Palestinians were also killed. Their loved ones mourned their deaths. Reporter Linda Gradstein has more from Jerusalem.
The Israeli army said that armed gunmen launched RPGs and sniper fire at Israeli army bulldozers near the humanitarian aid route in Rafah in southern Gaza. The army said it struck tunnels from where it believed the gunmen fired, as well as other areas in Gaza, and said Hamas had violated the ceasefire with Israel. Hamas said its members were not responsible for the attack.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says the U.S. fired on another drug smuggling boat Friday, killing three people. Arizona Democratic Senator Mark Kelly spoke to Margaret Brennan on CBS's Face the Nation about the strikes.
What I worry about, Margaret, are all these young military personnel that might find out, you know, months from now that what they did was illegal.
The president did not decide whether to give Ukraine long-range Tomahawk missiles at a meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky last week, initially declining an agreement. He addressed the matter on Fox.
We can't give all of our weapons to Ukraine. We just can't do that. And I've been very good to President Zelensky and to Ukraine, but we can't give, you know, if we're going to be short, I don't want to do that. I can't jeopardize the United States.
Thieves got away with a brazen heist at the Louvre Museum in Paris just after opening this morning. The BBC's Andrew Harding reports.
Just as the museum was opening up, they clambered up that ladder, three or four masked thieves, and then they broke into what we understand was a gallery containing essentially France's royal jewels. These were jewels belonging mostly to the Emperor Napoleon and his successors, so not the former royal family, who of course were sent to the guillotine before that.
The museum closed for the day. Prosecutors say the thieves stole nine items but dropped one of them outside, breaking it. It's day 19 of the government shutdown, and there's a new looming threat throughout the U.S. Denver Mayor Mike Johnston says an important food benefit is at risk in just a couple weeks.
We could have 100,000 Denver residents who will lose access to all SNAP benefits.
Millions do rely on the food stamp program. And right now, there are no new talks scheduled between Republicans and Democrats to negotiate an end to the government shutdown. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Farm news that impacts you and your community from the Midwest Farm Report throughout your day on 93.5 The Tap.
For Civic Media News, I'm Sholly Pittman. As the climate shifts, so does the science behind growing cranberries. Reporter Melissa Kay has more.
Staff at the Wisconsin Cranberry Research Station are working to ensure the future of the state's signature fruit by studying how cranberries can tolerate extreme temperatures and finding ways to extend the harvest season to reduce labor and equipment demands.
The inability to change in a changing environment is the textbook definition of extinction.
That's Grant Hawley, the executive director of the nonprofit Wisconsin Cranberry Growers Association. He said Wisconsin growers know what to do when change happens slowly.
When you're looking at fast changes, you need to know the whys. And that's where our researchers come into play.
They're able to look at changes happening at a molecular level and see how the cranberries are being affected, and also the symbiotic relationship that plants have with other organisms in the ground.
They're seeing how that bacteria inside of the soil is helping with nitrogen uptake. They're making sure that the fungus in the ground is helping us with water uptake.
Gabby Myers is the Research and Education Manager for the Wisconsin Cranberry Research and Education Foundation. She coordinates efforts from researchers across the state.
They're trying to create better cranberries, so maybe they're sweeter, firmer. So all different sorts of traits that they're trying to breed for, we provide a space for them to have those plots established.
Hybrid cranberry varieties are helping farmers diversify their marshes, producing more fruit on less land, and spreading out the harvest season.
They're trying to be able to make it to where harvest doesn't all happen in the same 2 weeks, because that's where you need extra equipment, you need extra people. It's just a terrible time if you have to do that.
Harvest season now starts as early as September and can run through October or later, depending on the year.
Reporter Melissa Kay. For Civic Media News, I'm Sholly Pittman. More news anytime at civicmedia.us.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, home for mornings with Pat Kreitlow weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m.
I'm meteorologist Brandon Bormans. Plenty of sunshine today, but it will be breezy and much cooler, wind gusts as high as 30 miles per hour, highs in the upper 50s. For tonight, mostly clear, lows in the upper 30s. On Monday, a few scattered showers in the afternoon, breezy again, a little warmer with highs near 63. Right now, 53 degrees.
Maggie Dawn.
I'm joined by my special guest, Tom Paulsiewicz. We dive into Donald Trump's plan to dispatch the IRS against his enemies and Magic Mike's refusal to seat the newest elected congresswoman. Don't miss it.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, the Chippewa Valley's home for Matt Nair on air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this remaining hour of our weekend broadcast on all things related to justice and the administration of law in America. Appropriately devoted all of our first hour to the discussion of this major oral argument of this past week in front of the United States Supreme Court that has before it this huge challenge to the future of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, which is the major implementing piece of the legislation from way back in 1965. Responsible Section 2 is for ensuring voting access, polling access to the polls around our nation by people of color, people of language, and prohibiting other forms of discrimination at the polls. Question before the Supreme Court is whether or not it is outdated. And people like Brett Kavanaugh, people like the Chief Justice, John Roberts, indicating that maybe the time has come for this to sunset, as he said in the case a number of years ago, Shelby County. Maybe those concerns back in 1965 are no longer ours. Mark writes in on our chat box that with the recent revelations of what some young Republicans are chatting about online, it appears that racism is still endemic, still out there, still a part, regrettably, horrifically, a part of our national consciousness and in some ways our national behavior. And so Mark obviously taking the position that this notion that somehow racism, or at least in the way it was in the past, is now a thing of the past, is simply a bad argument, not premised upon good law, not premised upon what's going on in America today. We will continue to monitor, of course, any time that the Supreme Court issues its major decision, probably the most significant decision in its docket of this term, could do it as late as June, could do it at any time prior to June, again, depending upon how sensitive it may be to the effects of that decision in Calais and Robinson on the possibility of doing more line drawing as late as months before the November election. Very, very tight, maybe impossible to do, but certainly going to have an impact if indeed the Supreme Court says you can no longer consider race when it comes to drawing lines and being concerned about disenfranchising people of color. If that becomes the law of the state of the land, our republic, our voting options, the ways in which we elect our representatives have changed dramatically. And yes, indeed, 14th and 15th Amendments are still there. But the enforcement mechanisms, as the attorney for the NAACP said, Congress does and often has enacted things like Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, to implement the Constitution. That's what's going on here, to provide that mechanism, that tool, as Ketanji Brown Jackson said, in those instances where discrimination is identified, not to say that it's everywhere, but in those places where it does occur and can be supported. It is not an easy thing to show, as she also notes. There was a reference in that oral argument to a case called Jingles, which is the case establishing the very high bar that you need to establish in court to show the test for racial discrimination in voting. That's the Jingles analysis, the Jingles test, G-I-N-G-L-E-S. Not easy to do it, but because of where we are in America, and because of the continuing concern, wherever that may be, wherever it may be, whenever it may come about, the advocacy on the other side for the continuation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act could, in fact, go away sometime soon. A major case, not only in this docket, in this term of the Supreme Court, but in recent American history, maybe the third case in the series of three that brings the Voting Rights Act to an end. Let's talk about other federal judges and revisit some of the concerns, some of the challenges that they have had in connection with, number one, the National Guard, secondarily, the conduct of law enforcement in our cities, and also this notion of firing federal employees in the midst of the shutdown. Somewhat unrelated, but yes, related in many ways, big and small. Let's begin right here in our own Seventh Circuit. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, you may recall well, as we have discussed in the past, that previously Judge April Perry, she is a district court judge in the Northern District of Illinois, has entered these orders finding no credible evidence that there is a danger of rebellion in the state of Illinois. And so rejecting outright with very strong language, looking around, saying there's no support for that, that there are no reasons for the deployment of the National Guard. What happened initially about a weekend ago when we were on the air is the Seventh Circuit said, well, you know what, we're not going to direct the National Guard to go away, but also they're not to be deployed. That was the order from the Seventh Circuit at that time, sort of to maintain the status quo, to support pretty much what the lower court judge had done, maintain that status quo until we have a chance to review this entirely. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals has done that since that time, and they have issued their order. On Thursday, they decided to continue to block President Trump's deployment of the National Guard in Chicago amid these ongoing protests, some of which have indeed become violent, but allowed those service members to remain under federal control. And so, again, affirming that, but along the way, affirming completely what Judge Perry has said about the lack of any support, any facts to indicate that indeed a rebellion is afoot. This three-judge panel, which is normal, three-judge panel of the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, meeting on the 27th floor of the Dirksen Building in downtown Chicago, saying unanimously, everybody agrees that the facts do not justify the president's actions in Illinois under the section of federal law that's known as Title 10. That's the provision that the president and his advisors, those others in the White House, have invoked to federalize National Guard troops to protect immigration personnel and government facilities, as he has described it in Chicago and other places. He's invoked that, but it's premised upon the notion that there is an insurrection, a rebellion. And the Seventh Circuit rejects that out of hand. No lack of clarity whatsoever. Here's what the Seventh Circuit says. At this stage, we cannot say the administration is likely to succeed in demonstrating that the president lawfully federalized the Guard under the provisions of Title 10. The judges, in particular, Judge Elena Rovner, David Hamilton, and Amy St. Eve, they are a combination of, yes, Democratic and Republican appointees, two of them from Republican presidents, one of them from a Democratic president. Again, we regret the fact that we've got to identify that, but an awful lot of focus is on that notion because the president has made that an issue. The reality is here, as in so many other cases, we have nonpartisan, apolitical decisions being made by federal judges who happen to be nominated and confirmed by presidents and senates of very different parties, but all saying the same thing. You don't have the authority to do this, Mr. President. Again, Title 10, which is what the president has invoked, allows the president, under appropriate circumstances, to call the National Guard into federal service when there is, here is the language, rebellion or danger of a rebellion against the U.S. government, or if the president is somehow unable, according to the language of the statute, to, in his normal course of business, unable with the regular forces to execute the laws of the United States. Judge Perry had said decisively, as we have reported and talked about in the past, neither one of those in place, no indication, no evidence whatsoever in the evidentiary hearing that she had that there was any showing by the Department of Justice that either of those is the case. There's no rebellion, no incapacity of the president to serve as the chief executor of the laws of the United States of America. And the court goes on to say that the authority invoked under Title 10 is simply not supported by the facts on the ground, and that the federal facilities somehow have come under a coordinated assault by violent groups intent on obstructing federal law enforcement activities. Seventh Circuit pretty much rejects all of that kind of exposition for justifying it. Instead, the court says that the decision by the Trump administration to try to do this, to affect the conduct of what's going on in the streets of Chicago, simply insufficient evidence of anything to suggest there's a danger, that there is a rebellion afoot, or that one will likely occur in the city of Chicago. Here is what they write. The spirited, sustained, and occasionally violent actions of demonstrators, they're acknowledging that there have been those instances. And yes, indeed, there have been them. There have been instances of violence on the streets of Chicago. But the spirited, sustained, and occasionally violent activities and demonstrations in protest of the federal government's immigration policies and actions without more, this is the Court of Appeals writing now, does not give rise to a danger of rebellion against the government's authority. As to whether Mr. Trump is unable to execute the laws of the United States, they write, with regular forces, as described in Title 10, the court says there's insufficient evidence that the demonstrations have affected the ability of federal officers to execute immigration laws. Federal facilities, federal facilities, including the processing facility in Broadview, where there's been an awful lot of focus. You have seen that on the news. Federal facilities have remained open despite regular demonstrations against the administration's immigration policies. And though federal officers have encountered sporadic disruptions, they have been quickly contained by local, state, and federal authorities. That's the word. That's the definitive word from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, again, keeping in place the prohibitions established by April Perry, now reaffirmed in very clear language by the Seventh Circuit, that, again, the National Guard can remain there but cannot be deployed. There is no basis to believe that there is an insurrection, that there is a rebellion afoot. The court, plainly, April Perry, will have more proceedings. Indeed, based upon what the Seventh Circuit has just done, she has ordered that her present order, affirmed now by the Seventh Circuit, remains in effect for a number more days, scheduled a hearing for October 22nd to determine whether to extend that temporary order, which has been affirmed by the Seventh Circuit, basically turning that into a permanent injunction and permanent finding. Very likely will do so, but once again, we'll take evidence to see what the situation is in just a few days here in the future. We'll determine whether or not the circumstances have changed or whether there is support at all, if any, for the notion that there is an insurrection, a rebellion afoot in Chicago. The second highest court in the land, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, has said, no, that's ridiculous. Take a look. We have looked around and there's nothing to support that at all. So things remain in Chicago as they have been. We'll get back to something else related to Chicago in just a moment from the pen of Sarah Ellis, who has tried, even apart from the National Guard, to affect the ways in which ICE authorities, different from the National Guard, are doing their jobs. We'll get to that in just a moment, and her frustrations with the government in terms of apparently not following her directives about how they are to do their jobs in Chicago. Before we get to that, however, let's go back and turn to one of the other major cities that we've also talked about, and that, of course, is Portland. We recall well that Judge Karen Immergut did something similar there in Oregon. When we come back, I'll tell you what she did. I'll tell you what the Ninth Circuit has done or not done recently, and what Judge Immergut has recently done to extend her own order with respect to the National Guard in Portland. All of that when Amicus Law Review continues.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
So my mother is thinking of switching from Verizon to Pure Talk, but she's worried the deal sounds too good to be true. Michael, she said, how can those Pure Talk people offer me the same basic service as Verizon for so much less money? I said, Ma, go ask Google how much Verizon spends on advertising and promotions. A few seconds later, my mother said, oh my goodness, $12 billion a year? That must be a typo. I'll tell you what I told my mom. It's not a typo. Verizon spends $12 billion a year on advertising and promotions, and their customers are paying for it. Well, Pure Talk doesn't spend that kind of money on commercials. Trust me, I would know. That's why they can offer you, and my mother, unlimited talk, text, and plenty of data on a crazy fast 5G network for just $25 a month. And if you're a business owner, you could really save a fortune. Dial pound 250, say the words Mike Rowe, you'll get an additional 50% off your first month. That's pound 250, Mike Rowe. Pure Talk. Everything you need and nothing you don't.
Where working people come to talk. It's the Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join me for an honest approach to the issues American working families care about. No talking points, no focus groups. Get ready for a heavy dose of democracy, fairness, grit, and no apologies. It's current affairs from a working class labor perspective. Facts are center, science is real, and everyone gets a seat at the table. The Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
A very funny stand-up comic, Mr. Mike Toomey. The last time I saw a Goldie Hawn film in the theater, the male lead was giving her a foot massage, yeah. And it was the worst foot I've ever seen. I actually said out loud, I went, ew. And my aunt started cracking up.
Yeah, maybe they could have had a stand-in, like a stunt foot.
Please, something. Even if it's a guy's foot, I don't care.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Teachers are diverse, skilled leaders, innovating to prepare students for our fast-changing world. Teaching shapes lives. Are you ready? Explore teaching at teach.org, supported by the U.S. Department of Education and 1 million teachers of color.
Join the family. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus Law Review. We are talking, as we so often do on this broadcast, all about federal district court judges imposing injunctions after evidentiary hearings, getting witness testimony, looking at documents, looking at other things presented by lawyers in the adversarial system of the proceedings in their courtrooms, and determining in the end, in so many ways, big, small, and in between, that the president does not have the authority to do what he's doing. In this case involving the National Guard, finding unanimously, at least up to now, that there is not an insurrection, there is not a situation in America, in Chicago, in Portland, that is in the nature of rebellion to justify the entry of the National Guard. And oh, by the way, the president not impeded, not prevented from enforcing the laws of the United States of America. That is what? That is what the Seventh Circuit of the Court of Appeals here in Chicago, in our circuit, here in our Seventh Circuit, has said. And now we go to Portland, out west, where we know well what Judge Karen Immergut, I-M-M-E-R-G-U-T, has done in the past. She, like, just like Judge April Perry, has also found no insurrection. There's no rebellion here to justify the entry of the National Guard. She has in the past, as you know well, said that there was some sporadic evidence in Portland, but any evidence demonstrating that those episodes of violence were part of an organized attempt to overthrow the government in a rebellion-type mode simply doesn't exist. Therefore, National Guard, do not go in. That has been her order. As you know, the president, the administration, appealed that decision to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Ninth Circuit ruled, as we reported last weekend, that Oregon National Guard members could stay under federal control until they issued a broader ruling. But they left in place Judge Immergut's temporary order that barred the troops from being deployed. At the hearing, as we know well, that panel, the Ninth Circuit, seemed to take very seriously the arguments by the administration that the deployment would be legal. And they questioned Judge Immergut's conclusion that a military presence was not needed. We'll see what the Ninth Circuit does with all of that. But that's the status of things in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, even as Judge Immergut, based upon what the Ninth Circuit has done up to this point, has also done something else, just like the Judge April Perry has done in Northern Illinois. She has extended her previous orders preventing the administration, preventing the president from sending National Guard into Portland, Oregon. Judge Immergut on Wednesday extending two temporary restraining orders that would have expired very soon. The extension applies for another 14 days. Case scheduled for trial. Again, more evidentiary hearings at the end of this month on October 29th. The judge once again writing, "This is a nation of constitutional law, not martial law," and justifying her decision to extend this injunctive action until that time. Immergut had ruled that deference is not equivalent to ignoring the facts on the ground, and indicating that the president's idea of the situation in Portland was simply untethered to the facts. All that coming out from Judge Immergut as she extends the injunctive action with respect to the National Guard there in Portland. And again, all of this a part of a linguistic interpretation, which is important, but also as both judges, and at least one court of appeals have said up to now, premised upon the facts. And that is to be underscored. These are not judges who are simply responding knee-jerk analysis to a petition put in front of them and entering an order. They're having evidentiary hearings, and they're hearing about, they're learning about, they're seeing what's going on in the streets. You have also seen some of the various memes and videos posted indicating in a humorous way the mayhem, the rebellion, the insurrection that's going on in Chicago and in Portland. Obviously, just the opposite, including one by the mayor of those cities and the governor of the state of Illinois, ridiculing the notion that there is a rebellion afoot in Illinois. Those things meant to underscore in a silly but humorous way, but nonetheless very serious way, the notion that the factual predicates for National Guard intervention are simply not there. And that has a legal implication and also a practical implication of what happens in the streets of America. In the same streets of America, going back to the city of Chicago, bouncing around our nation in this second segment of Amicus Law Review, let's go back and talk about what is going on in the streets and the work and the activities of another judge. Her name is Sarah Ellis, E-L-L-I-S. She once again, like Judge Perry, she's a federal district court judge in the Northern District of Illinois. And she has been wrestling with the behavior, the conduct of federal agents on the streets of Chicago. And not National Guard, federal agents. You have seen a lot of this in the videos. Ellis issued a temporary restraining order several days ago, last week, after a coalition, a group of people,
their principally journalists and some protesters got together, sued in federal court, brought a civil complaint into her court, saying that federal law enforcement agents were targeting people engaging in peaceful activity. And that included, they identified themselves, including multiple reporters who said that they had pepper balls fired on them despite being identified as the press. And the court, that is Judge Ellis, in the wake of that, entered certain orders saying you've got to behave. You can engage in law enforcement, legitimate law enforcement, pursuant to the regular practices and procedures that we know well in America. But she required, among other things, all agents to wear cameras. She agreed that some flexibility was required, but has required that the law enforcement officers of the federal government need to follow the rules. They need to be very mindful about the ways in which they engage with the public, can't use tear gas indiscriminately, can't drive cars into crowds, can't do other things that are not consistent with law enforcement in America. When I come back, we'll talk more about what Judge Sarah Ellis has said to the government, why language is once again important, and what's going on in Chicago here on Amicus Law Review.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, Eau Claire, the Valley's home of Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
93.5 The Tap, Eau Claire's real news and great conversation, and home to mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
CBS News Brief. Thieves used power tools to rob crown jewels from the Louvre Museum in Paris. Jim Carpenter from Santa Cruz, California, was inside just about to view the Mona Lisa when he was evacuated.
This is our last day of a long trip, and this is the most exciting part today.
Israel notified the U.S. before striking targets in Gaza after it says Hamas militants fired on Israeli troops, killing two soldiers. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The army said it struck tunnels from where it believed the gunmen fired, as well as other areas in Gaza, and said Hamas had violated the ceasefire with Israel. Hamas said its members were not responsible for the attack.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says U.S. forces attacked another drug smuggling vessel Friday, killing three people. Arizona Democratic Senator Mark Kelly criticized the series of strikes.
This is the wrong move for this president. Coast Guard has the resources to do this.
CBS News Brief, I'm Wendy Gillette.
A late night for the Pack. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports here in Phoenix, where the Packers play the Arizona Cardinals at State Farm Stadium. A late arrival, though, last night for Green Bay. The team plane had mechanical problems and was not cleared to fly, so the Packers waited over 5 hours before another plane could arrive from Detroit and take them from Austin Straubel Airport in Green Bay to Phoenix. They didn't take off until 7 o'clock last night, and it's nearly a four-hour flight. I'll have a recap of today's game coming up later tonight. College football, the Wisconsin Badgers losing to number one ranked Ohio State 34-0. Luke Fickell.
To not find a way to put points on the board will never give us a chance. So we know we have to find a way to be able to do that, and we got to get a hell of a lot better at it.
That's the Badgers head coach, Luke Fickell. Wisconsin on the road next week against number eighth ranked Oregon. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Peach Wabba. K-pop Demon Hunters is a phenomenon kids can't seem to get enough of, and their parents can't seem to get the original soundtrack out of their heads. Buckle up, folks, or buy some earplugs, because the film is returning to the big screen for some Halloween sing-alongs. The Netflix animated fantasy adventure tells the story of a K-pop girl band that protects people from demons with song. Netflix is behind the theatrical release and is encouraging moviegoers to wear costumes. Pop Culture Jeopardy has been renewed for a season 2. In a related story, there's a show called Pop Culture Jeopardy, and it's already been on for a whole season. The show will be moving from Amazon Prime to Netflix and has the same answer with a question format as the actual Jeopardy. Host Colin Jost is currently in talks to return to the show, which should be back in 2026. For more showbiz fun, tune in to Nightlight with me, Peach Wabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Ninety-three-five, The Tap, Eau Claire's real news and great conversation.
And home to Matt and Air on Air, weekday mornings from 9 to 11.
I'm meteorologist Brandon Bormans. Plenty of sunshine today, but it will be breezy and much cooler. Wind gusts as high as 30 miles per hour, highs in the upper 50s. For tonight, mostly clear, lows in the upper 30s. On Monday, a few scattered showers in the afternoon, breezy again, a little warmer with highs near 63. Currently, it's 55 degrees.
This is Robert Pilot, host of Nativerts Radio. On our show, we talk about Native issues like treaties, protecting Mother Earth, and holding our elected officials accountable. You'll also hear from Turtle Island voices like Arvina Martin, State Representative Heather Keeler, Ruth Anna Buffalo, Dr. Anthony Stately, State Senator Mary Kunish, Robert Lilligren, and Bob Blake. Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues.
Native Roots Radio, weeknights at 8 on your local Civic Media radio station.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Trump still thinks he's a game show host at The Apprentice. Heard this great perspective about Tiffany not getting Trump's endorsement. If Josh Schumann feels like he's got to take some shots at Tiffany, which might weaken him, but it makes him look better to Trump to maybe get the endorsement, this is what Trump likes. He doesn't have any incentive to endorse Tiffany as long as he can keep playing him and Schumann off each other.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow. Weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we will recap all the events from the weekend, including local No Kings rallies across Wisconsin. I hope you can join us.
Matinair on Air, weekday mornings 9 to 11.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. My name is Jim Santel, focusing on these various decisions by federal district court judges and appellate court judges responding to the initiatives, the attempts, the movements of this administration to place, yes, in one area, the focus on National Guard, premised upon the ridiculous notion that there are insurrections and there are rebellions afoot in major American cities, the judges rejecting that to this time. And then we also have District Court Judge Sarah Ellis. She is a district court judge, a trial court judge in the Northern District of Illinois in Chicago. And she is wrestling with a related but somewhat separate issue, which is what do we do about all of this violence in some areas in Chicago being accomplished at the hands of the initiative of federal law enforcement agencies. And what she does is she responds after some journalists and some protesters claim that the federal law enforcement agencies there are targeting people involved in peaceful activity, doing things in of a violent nature. Multiple reporters said they're subject to pepper balls fired on them, other things going on. And initially, she says, that is the judge, says that federal agents cannot target journalists who are not interfering with them, cannot simply shoot pepper balls, other things at them that obstructs their particular work, their mission as journalists. She also says federal agents are prohibited from using tear gas and less lethal munitions on anyone who does not impose an immediate threat to safety. In other words, stand down. You can keep things safe and secure. Law enforcement knows how to do that. They're trained how to do that. But you can't be the aggressor on this, in this area. And she went on to say that the issue is that the Department of Homeland Security, using force in a manner that violates the constitutional rights of peaceful protesters, journalists, and essentially clergy members. That all from the pen of Sarah Ellis. Now, it gets more complicated and much more troubling, because at a hearing of just this past week, Judge Ellis takes the bench and she says this, words that no one wants to hear from a federal judge before whom you are appearing. She says, I'm not happy. She says, I'm really not happy. One week after she issues a sweeping order trying to calm these intense responses of federal agents to these protests against ICE enforcement and Border Patrol activities in Chicago, the judge tells both sides to come back to her courtroom for our own intensive discussion. She says this. She says, I live in Chicago, if folks haven't noticed, and I'm not blind, right? So I don't live in a cave. I have a phone. I have a TV. I have a computer, and I tend to get news. She goes on to say, once again, Judge Sarah Ellis,
that news reports were leading her to believe that the Trump administration is not following her instructions. Gosh, have we seen that before? The answer is yes. Is this a situation where, once again, in the context of the continuing constitutional crisis that we are in, we've got one branch of government simply looking at another one and saying, no, we're not doing that? The judge says, from what I'm seeing, I'm having serious concerns that my orders are not being followed. She's announcing that she is expanding her restraining order, requiring all federal agents who are part of this Operation Midway Blitz, who have body cameras, to have them on during encounters with protesters. That's a part of her initial and expanded order as well. Department of Justice still is opposing her on that. And she is going on to say that she is upset by what she is seeing in the wake of the directives that she has issued to stop this kind of confrontational, aggressive movements of federal law enforcement officers. She says this: there's a reason the Chicago Police Department has policies about car chases and where they occur and where they need to stop. She suggests, of course, that this situation resulting from Border Patrol agents using tactics not appropriate under traditional law enforcement means, including the Chicago Police Department. She says this, and here's the great lesson coming out of Judge Ellis's courtroom just this past week. We're not on the border, she says. We are in an urban, densely populated area where crowds are going to converge when there's a commotion, where appropriate crowd control is important. She acknowledges that. Trying to apprehend and detain people is very, very different when you're in an urban setting than when you're out there on the border. She is upset. She is not happy, as she says, on the record to the parties in this case, and she's not happy with the government. She has demanded that an ICE field director appear in her court, as she said, to explain to me why I am seeing images of tear gas being deployed and reading reports that there were no warnings given before it was deployed out in the field. Unclear whether that representative, that ICE field director, will appear in her court. Basically, this is what's called an order to show cause why contempt should not be found. She is not happy. That is an understatement, a diplomatic understatement of her stature right now, her position on this. And it is significant, again, in two ways, which is, once again, the courts are trying to maintain this balance between legitimate law enforcement, which there is, law enforcement that does have the obligation, yes, to keep us safe and secure in service to us, but to do it consistent with the policies and practices that have been a part of our traditions in America for decades long. And even beyond that, we train all the time state, local, federal law enforcement officers about accomplishing that balance. Is it easy? No, not at all. Because sometimes very important decisions, snap decisions, need to be made in the midst of the commotion that the judge is talking about. Sometimes, most often, those decisions can be justified, but sometimes they're wrong. And afterwards, there is analysis about those and hopefully remedies to them. What the judge is saying, when you're going in from the start and doing the very things that I've directed you not to do with tear gas and driving cars into crowds and not wearing body cameras, when I've told you to do just that, that is of a different piece. And that is what she is upset about. It is significant as well. Another rule of law issue here in the courtroom of Sarah Ellis. This administration, through the ICE authorities and through the federal government, apparently is saying, no, no, we're not doing that, Judge. That's the constitutional crisis that we have been in since mid-March of this year that continues to grow and to be illustrated on a regular basis. There is another case, yet another one, involving yet another federal district court judge. And it does not, in this instance, have to do with violence or law enforcement on the streets of America. Instead, it has to do with the shutdown. Day 18, going into day 19 soon of the federal shutdown. As I have commented before, one of the basic things that we need to anticipate, need to expect of our representatives, Republicans and Democrats both, the most fundamental thing is to keep the government in operation. during the long period of time that I served as an assistant U.S. attorney and then a U.S. attorney, one of the great challenges was keeping the operations locally up and running in law enforcement, in prosecution, in civil litigation, the criminal, the civil cases that we do, investigations going on behalf of whom? The people of the Eastern District of Wisconsin and beyond. Keeping that operational when you're sending people home who have the responsibility to do just that, that is a default by our United States Congress, the House of Representatives, United States Senate, and yes, indeed, the President. And we can point fingers at politics and describe the reasons why, and it's important to understand the reasons why, but the upshot is that government is failing us right now in doing what it's most fundamentally supposed to do. That's James Madison saying you put a budget together and you keep us operational. In the midst of that, because of the problems as we go into days 18 and 19 here, the president taking advantage of that situation in ways that are also unconstitutional and inappropriate and illegal, and announcing that some 4,100 workers, perhaps more, are being laid off because of what? Because of the suspension in budgeting, because of the suspension in the federal budget, the fact that we do not have a budget. That's how he describes it. But in fact, those two things, as another judge, Susan Ilston, we've heard from her before. She's in California as well. She's in San Francisco, has said that these things are, for the most part, unrelated and you can't do them. Federal Judge Susan Ilston, just this past week, ordering the Trump administration once again to stop doing what you're doing. There's no legal, no constitutional basis for pursuing the layoffs of about 4,100 federal employees during the government shutdown. Susan Ilston saying this during a hearing on Wednesday. Once again, evidence presented to her, witnesses, evidence in front of her, said that she was granting a request from unions representing federal workers for an emergency order pausing the layoffs that began about a week or so ago. The judge says this, as of right now, the temporary restraining order that I am ordering is in effect. The order, she said, bars the administration, bars Donald Trump, bars this administration from moving ahead with layoff plans for members of several unions that sued over these plans announced by the president, announced by the White House, or issuing any new layoff notices for those unions' members. It will remain in effect while the union's legal challenge plays out. The unions, the groups that got together to bring this lawsuit in front of Judge Ellis, had said that the government is unlawfully using the lapse in funding as justification for the layoffs, that the one does not correlate to the other. And Ilston said she saw evidence suggesting the administration was indeed consistent with that disconnect, that she had seen evidence that the administration had taken advantage, her words, of the lapse in government spending, in government functioning, to assume that all bets are off, that the laws simply don't apply to them anymore. She went on to say that she believed that the planned layoffs were impermissible in part, and we have seen this from the words of the president himself, because, as she said, she made the finding based upon her evidence in front of her, that they're politically motivated. Presidents talked about Democrat programs and things that are partisan in nature and targeting Democrats in particular. She pointed to statements by the president saying just that, that officials are targeting programs and agencies favored by Democrats. Now, you'd like to think that those programs and policies are in place. They're passed by Congress. Majorities in Congress recently and in years past, decades past, by, in most instances, some bipartisan coalitions. The president once again politicizing even this and deciding to, what, punish employees in the federal service, civil servants who do not day in and day out bring to their important jobs a partisan perspective. They leave those at home, in their cars, at the door. Nonetheless, invoking some partisan views about the fact that there are Democrat programs, Democrat initiatives, Democrats who want these things done. Therefore, I'm punishing them by terminating employments here. It is the latest instance of his politicizing his actions there. And again, Judge Ilston there in California having none of it and saying it is the politics that infuses what's going on being trumpeted out loud in this case. Political motivation cannot be a part of this. And she adds, these activities are being undertaken contrary to the laws. You're acting in violation of the law, Mr. President. And they do, in fact, have governing force here. That's what Judge Susan Ilston has said this past week. Undeniably, that's going to be taken up once again to the appeals court. More of that litigation in the future. We come back for our final segment, some comments upon the recent indictment of John Bolton and the ways in which it's different from some others that are out there. All of that when Amicus Law Review continues.
As Wisconsin as a fish fry on a Friday night, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Did the average S&P 500 CEOs earn in less than 2 days what their typical worker earned in all of 2023? Yes. In 2023, the average S&P 500 CEO earned about $17 million, or about $46,849 per day, compared to under $64,000 per year for the average worker. Median figures were similar. CEOs made $16.3 million, while median workers earned about $81,000, equivalent to less than 2 days of CEO pay. High CEO compensation remains a stark contrast to the modest worker earnings across major U.S. companies. I'm Trisha Young for Wisconsin Watch. Fact briefs are bite-sized fact checks of trending claims produced by Wisconsin Watch and GigaFact. Read more at wisconsinwatch.org.
My part-time service in the Army National Guard makes it possible for me to be more for the community I call home. My training helps me at work when I lead by example. My service in the Army National Guard allows me to keep my community and those I care about safe from threats. Learn more about how you too can live and serve part-time close to home by visiting NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard, aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. The conservative majority of the U.S. Supreme Court appeared to agree October 15th with arguments that the Voting Rights Act Section 2's majority-minority voting districts conflicted with the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. A decision is expected next year. Chief Justice John Roberts signaled that the court's 2023 Milligan precedent, a very similar case, may not apply to Louisiana versus Calais. Justice Kagan later pointed out that the court rejected several similar arguments by the state of Alabama defending its discrimination. Louisiana argued that the court-mandated majority-minority districts giving minority voters an equal chance to elect the candidate of their choice puts the state in a position to discriminate against other voters. Justices Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett both voiced support for an endpoint to sunset such opportunity districts. The court's Jingles test, used to determine if a group qualifies for such a district, was also questioned by the conservative justices. In her opening argument, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund's Janae Nelson said that should the court strike down Section 2, it would be, quote, a staggering reversal of precedent that would throw maps across the country into chaos. There are 148 VRA majority-minority districts in 28 states, according to Ballotpedia. We've linked a transcript of the arguments at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Download the Civic Media app in the Google Play or Apple App Store and take us everywhere. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus Law Review in the final segment of our weekend broadcast, focusing now upon one of the other major rule of law stories, Justice Administration stories of the week. That is the indictment by a federal grand jury of former National Security Advisor John Bolton, no longer in government for a long period of time. But the National Security Advisor in Donald Trump's first term became one of his most outspoken critics, and that's an important issue. He was indicted just this past week by a federal grand jury in Maryland. based upon the fact that the charges, that is including retention of documents at his home there in Maryland, the indictment against John Bolton, 18 counts, an extensive indictment, accuses him of using his personal email and a messaging app to share about 1,000 pages of what are called diary notes about his day-to-day activities as Donald Trump's national security advisor way back in 2018 and 2019. The notes, which according to this very extensive indictment, were sent to two family members who did not have security clearances, and they included apparently national defense information, details about things that were classified as top secret. The allegations, again, go on to note that they were not identified, that two members of the family were not identified, but plainly indicating, according to the indictment, that John Bolton understood the nature of what he is doing when he's sending these on. One entry begins, the intel briefer said, while in the Situation Room, I learned, all of that indicating that he is disclosing things that are national securities in nature, and also indicating in exchanges with his family members that they're using the app and they're supposed to be involved with encryption, supposed to be not talking about things. One of the recipients wrote back, shh, all of this indicating that they knew that these pieces of information were not to be disclosed. Lots and lots of information in the allegations in that omnibus indictment, 18 counts, using personal email messaging, and also engaging, plainly, the theme will be some violations of our national security. Lots of accounts inside what is in many ways a talking indictment with respect to John Bolton. You may recall, well, we talked about this earlier, that he was previously the subject of an FBI search at his Maryland home. In August, they removed computer files and documents and papers. Not at all surprising that in the wake of that, probably a lot of that, the basis for the grand jury indictment now. Significantly, this one appears to follow some normal department channels. We know the investigation was initiated during the Biden administration. It was not pursued at that time. But we know that Kelly Hayes, who's the U.S. attorney in Maryland, among the career prosecutors here who reviewed this, signed off on the charges in conjunction with the Justice Department's National Security Division. It is unlike those other investigations, those other prosecutions involving James Comey and Letitia James that are out there, where the investigations lead to indictments only after the career people, the people who are doing these investigations, decide they can't indict, they cannot seek charges from the grand jury, and they leave or they're departed. Here you've got some legitimacy in the process. And for that reason, while we are always quick to note that any defendant, including John Bolton, is presumed innocent until proven guilty by a jury. He has pleaded not guilty just this past week. The reality is that regularity underscores the problem here with what the president has done. In the wake of this indictment, the president has said, oh, he's a bad guy, about John Bolton. He has celebrated the fact, in the wake of his incredible criticism of John Bolton, and to be fair, John Bolton has focused on the president as well, criticized him in a book, scathing allegations about the president. The president returns those in kind, and the president says, well, that's the way it goes. All those statements, once again, indicating that the John Bolton indictment partakes of two things. One is entirely possible, maybe even likely, that the probable cause set forth in this indictment is valid. It may well be, we don't know, that a jury will find that John Bolton is guilty of these violations of retaining these classified pieces of information, national security information, sending them on as a part of his work on a book, exchanging them, sending them to family members. That's a violation of the law. And if it's true, it stands on its own, and he should be convicted of that. Again, assuming that there's sufficient evidence for that. At the same time, and this is the problem, this is the rub, the problem
problem is that he's also on the list of the president's enemies. And when the president identifies anyone as an adversary, an enemy of his, it raises the specter of a vindictive prosecution. We know that Letitia James, we know that James Comey, and now also John Bolton will raise the specter that this is not a real prosecution, not based upon facts, but instead, like those others, based upon vindictiveness. This is retribution in action. And the problem with what the president has done in speaking aloud about all of these people is both of those things could be true. John Bolton could be, in fact, guilty of these offense conduct behaviors described in the indictment, and also an adversary. And for that reason, underscoring the inappropriate nature of the president's talking about any of these people, and therefore potentially compromising the very investigation, maybe a legitimate investigation, legitimate charges against someone that the president would like to see convicted. That is the jumble. That's the mess caused by what the president has done in all of these cases. The cases involving Letitia James and James Comey and John Bolton, they are different in nature, and John Bolton's case partakes of both some legitimacy and both some illegitimacy. It is up to a federal district court judge to sort that out as that case goes ahead, as the evidence is exchanged between the prosecution and the defense, and as this problem continues in the destruction of the wall between the Department of Justice and the White House. We'll talk more about the Bolton indictment and other things in the rule of law in our nation next weekend on Amicus, a Law Review. Have a good weekend, everybody.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Wendy Gillette. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says U.S. forces fired on another drug smuggling vessel in the Caribbean Friday, killing three people. It's the seventh such attack. Arizona Democratic Senator Mark Kelly criticized the actions on CBS's Face the Nation.
It puts a tremendous number of Americans in harm's way, the U.S. military, the guys flying those missions now in B-52s close to the coast. Those folks are at risk.
President Trump posted today that Colombia's president is an illegal drug dealer and that he's slashing U.S. funding to the country. Israel says Hamas militants fired on its troops, killing two soldiers. The military then hit targets in Gaza, killing at least 19 Palestinians. This is how it sounded at a local hospital. The